Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me today. It's time for another episode of It's All About Food. Today, I want to talk about being involved with your life. Being involved with your life. Does that sound funny to you? A few years back, I interviewed an artist named Tom Lieber. And I invite you to check out my archives, and you can read that interview or listen to that interview. All of my shows the past 9+ years are not only archived, but transcribed at responsibleeatingandliving.com. I hope you check that out sometime when you're trying to be a little bit more involved with your life and you want to figure out what to do next. You might listen to some of those shows. They're very helpful. So Tom said, when I interviewed him, how uninvolved do you want to be with your life? Think about that. How uninvolved do you want to be with your life? And that really struck a chord with me. I'm flipping it a little bit because I like to take negatives out of things that I talk about. And I'm saying, how involved do you want to be with your life? So that's the theme of today's show, and I'm going to be threading it into everything that I talk about today. I went to see the movie Eating Animals this week. Have you heard about it? In 2009, Jonathan Safran Foer wrote the book Eating Animals. And he's considered one of the greatest American writers right now. He's written some other wonderful books, fiction books primarily. Perhaps you've seen them or the movies made from them. He's written Everything is Illuminated, which is a fictionalized story about a shtetl in Poland during the Holocaust. And the next book he wrote was Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, about a young boy whose father died during the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. They've both been made into films. The first was with Elijah Wood, and the second one was with Tom Hanks and Sandra Bullock. I really enjoyed reading both books and watching the films. And then he came out with a nonfiction book called Eating Animals. At the time, I thought, this is it. This book is going to change the world. I thought it would be this era's complement or follow-up to John Robbins' Diet for New America that came out in 1987. It covered all of the top issues, health, environment, treatment of animals, from Jonathan Safran Foer's personal perspective, from his culture, his tradition, raising a family, his internal struggles, what's right, what's wrong. And he's a great writer, so presenting all of this information in that format was very compelling. And he struggled between being a vegetarian and a vegan. It was very honest. And Natalie Portman was influenced by this book, and she decided to make a film of it. She and Jonathan Safran Foer and the director, Christopher Dylan Quinn, are the producers of this new film. And I got to see it just a few days ago. So just as I thought the book would really make big changes in the world, unfortunately, it didn't. I was hoping that the film would really do it. And I have to tell you, I was disappointed. Now, you might want to go and see it, and I encourage you to, and bring everyone along. It does bring out some very important points. But I feel it was a soft sell of what people really need to be told. And that's something that irks me all the time. I'm always frustrated when I speak with medical doctors, nurses, anyone in the medical profession who feels like they have to talk down to their patients, like their patients aren't going to get it. So they give them the minimal amount of information. Now, some of it could be because they don't know it themselves. But a lot of times, like cardiologists will say, oh yeah, my patients, they don't want to change their diet. They just want the medication. And I'm like screaming, saying, you have to tell them the truth. You have to be strong. You have to keep reminding them why it's important to take responsibility for your life. And how involved do you want to be with your life? Sometimes it takes work, but it's worth it. Anyway, back to the film. Why was it a soft sell, in my opinion? The film was loosely related to the book. It did not mention at all Jonathan Safran Foer's personal story, which I thought was a mistake. But hey, I didn't make the film. I didn't get all that money to make the film. Who am I? But I have my opinion, and I'm giving it to you. They decided not to use his story. Instead, they profiled a number of different farmers who are raising animals, quote, humanely, unquote, for food. I will admit that humane farming, and whenever I say humane farming, the humane is in quotes, folks. Anyone who's doing humane farming, or if you're buying and eating flesh, it's better to purchase it from someone who's raising it, quote, humanely, unquote, rather than getting it from a factory farm for many, many, many reasons. But that's not the right message. The message in the film was like, we have to do more of this. We have to go back and farm animals the way they used to be farmed, not in these crammed, filthy, horrific, horribly cruel factory farms, these confined animal feedlots, these closed, not able to be viewed by the public factories. And basically that's what the film was about. They talked to different farmers. Some of them were frustrated about how they had to raise chickens for Tyson and how they were deeply in debt and how difficult it was. Another was a longtime turkey farmer and how he talked about how he loved his birds. And another raised cattle, another raised pigs. And over it was, we have to get back to the way animals used to be raised for food. I don't ever want to go backwards. I want this civilization to go forward. The message should be, we need to eat plants. And maybe there is a message about going backwards, because I think that humans, when we first started walking around on this planet, we were foragers eating plants. But nobody really knows that for sure, and it doesn't really matter. What matters is today, and we know that animals are not ours to do with whatever we want. Non-human animals are phenomenally intelligent. Many of them show us unconditional love, something that humanity really needs to get on board with. And they all deserve to raise their families, be with their friends, be able to roll around in the dirt and ruffle their feathers and breathe fresh air and eat what they're supposed to be eating and live a life of challenges, joys, sorrows, but their own life, their own self-determined life. And humane farming, quote, humane, unquote, farming, does not do that. And it just boggles my mind. You see these farmers in the film talk about loving their animals, and then they slaughter them. I'm silent now because I just don't get it. Do you? Can you explain that to me, why it's okay to love someone and then slit their throats? Yeah. So that was the big problem I had with the film. The film was gorgeous. The filming was gorgeous. Kind of a strange thing, actually, to see beauty in horror. There were some great shots. Thanks to drones now, we're able to see overhead a lot of these pig farms in North Carolina specifically that you really can't get to off the road. And they're all enclosed, so you can't look inside. But overhead, you can see a lot, and it's very telling. First, you can see how many there are, and there are a gazillion of them, and they're all enclosed, and they're surrounded by these lovely bright pink lagoons. It's gorgeous. The green fields, the white factory farms, the white warehouses, or whatever you want to call them, and the bright pink balloons. It's a stunning picture. But when you realize that the bright pink lagoons are pools of excrement and urine, it's an interesting contrast. And plus, we can't smell in the film. We can't smell when we visualize something on a film. And I'm looking forward to the day when we have smellotography or something where we can smell and maybe even taste things in a film. But if you could smell, it would be a very different picture. It wouldn't be beautiful. The smells are horrible. And unfortunately, the people who live near these farms, typically they are of communities of color, impoverished communities, people who have a difficult time fighting for what they deserve because they're struggling with so many other things. And these lagoons, you may notice, when they're filled and there's nowhere for the shit to go, literally, they spray that excrement and urine filled liquid all over the fields nearby. They put it in the atmosphere and people complain. People get sick. It's crazy, and it's not regulated. And these lagoons too, they seep into the water supply. How is this allowed? And why aren't we screaming any louder? I'm screaming! But it's all because people want to eat pork, which is made from a sentient, intelligent animal known as a pig. And pigs, you may know, are smarter than dogs. And they're very loving. And they can be a lot of fun. They may not be the most cuddly and attractive things that we've seen. And then maybe that's why we've relegated them to food. A number of people in the film I have interviewed here on this show. There was Jean Bauer, Dr. Neil Barnard, and Bruce Friedrich, all promoting a somewhat vegan message. There was Christopher Leonard, author of The Meat Racket, who I've spoken with, and I encourage you to check out that interview at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And I remembered when I spoke with Christopher Leonard, after he had spoken about all of the horrors in animal agriculture, from health, environment, from the treatment of the workers, and the tremendous cost that the taxpayers pay, which is invisible to us, in order to raise animals to feed people. And I asked him, because I knew he wasn't vegan, I asked him, do you have a good defense for eating meat? And he really didn't have an answer. You could go and listen to the interview. Because it doesn't make sense. And that's what really boggles my mind. People like Christopher Leonard, who research and write books, and still, the message doesn't even get into them to make significant change. So he spoke quite a bit in the film. Okay, maybe I shouldn't say this, but he didn't look like a healthy guy. Bruce Friedrich, Jean Barr, and Dr. Neil Barnard looked the healthiest of the group. They also included Dr. Temple Grandin, and you may be familiar with her. She is someone who works in the animal agriculture industry. She says she cares about animals. She's risen to fame because she's done some great work despite her autism, and she's created some things that are supposed to help animals want to march up the plank to be slaughtered in a way that's, easier for them. less cruel, less scary, perhaps. And I was very frustrated because the people featured in the film primarily were white men, older white men. And then we had Dr. Temple Grandin, a white woman. We splash in somebody with a little autism there, who really didn't have an appropriate message, in my opinion. And there are so many wonderful women and people of color whose messages are powerful, especially with respect to exploitation, which is really what we're talking about here, exploitation of sentient beings, exploitation of the planet, and exploiting our own health. For what purpose? Well, for some people to profit, and for convenience, I suppose. And then I think, how involved are you with your life? How involved are you with your life? So when I'm talking about this soft sell and being dumbed down, the audience is dumbed down in a way because, I don't know, Natalie Portman and Jonathan Safran Foer and Christopher Quinn didn't think that the audience would like their film as much if there was a go vegan message. But it's right there in front of us in living color, death, because we don't want to think about it. It's hard enough looking at it. We don't want to look at it very often. And then we want to go and leave and have dinner and have treats. And we don't want to be involved. We don't want to be involved. And it's our life. It's our lives. It's the life of our families. And it's the life of the planet. And it's the lives of all these other sentient beings. Why don't we want to be involved? Why are we numbing ourselves? Yeah, it's hard. The world is violent. It's not a friendly place. There are pockets of beauty and loveliness and kindness and compassion. And I try and put that out there all the time. I like to say, tune in love on this show, because love is the only answer. Love is the only answer. And if we really want to rise above and get away from all of this violence in the world, we each in our own lives have to get involved in our own lives, find the love deep down, hiding within ourselves, and share it. Share it with others. Be the person you want to be. Get involved with your life. Be an activist in whatever way you find comfortable. But let's be true, and let's share the truth. You know what the best part of the film was? I went with my friend Linda Long. I've interviewed her a number of times. She's the author of Great Chefs Cook Vegan. She interviewed many different chefs who were not vegan and had them prepare something vegan, and she photographed them. It's a beautiful book. And she also wrote the book Virgin Vegan. She's been vegan for 42 years. I keep telling you I'm celebrating 30 years as a vegan. Linda's way ahead of me. And when we left, I was kind of frustrated because there was a Q&A with Natalie Portman and the director, Chris Quinn, but we weren't allowed to ask questions. There was an interviewer, and he was controlling the whole thing, so we couldn't ask any questions. And as we were leaving, there were like five or six young people in front of us, and one of them had some kind of vegan t-shirt. And I looked at them all, and I was saying, "You're vegan, I assume?" And they were all nodding. We had the most wonderful conversation with those people about being vegan, the importance of being vegan, how they decided to be vegan, what they're doing about it. It was so inspiring. The film was not inspiring. These people were. So I'm grateful for them. And if they're listening, thanks for being who you are. A few of them had just gone vegan in the last year. One guy had been vegan for 6 years. It was beautiful. We also discovered just before the film a restaurant. It's been around for a little over a year and a half, I think. It was right by the theater over near 12th Avenue and 57th Street. So that's the west side of Manhattan, right by the Hudson River. The restaurant is called, I can't even pronounce it, Ouisia. Who's Greek out there and can help me with this word? Ousia. It serves Mediterranean fare. And I had Googled it before we got there because we were looking for a place close to go to near the theater where we might get a bite. It's a gorgeous restaurant. There was a lot of money dumped into this restaurant. It's big, which is unusual for Manhattan because real estate is so expensive. Beautifully appointed and a lot of wonderful vegan items on the menu. The host greeted us, Shane. He's vegan. Our server was vegetarian. His wife is vegan. They were really plugged in and they knew what was available, what they recommended. It was fantastic. If you want to see what we were eating, you can go to my blog, What Vegans Eat. Day 12, 21. Yes, I have over 1,200 daily posts on the What Vegans Eat blog. And if you're ever thinking about what vegans eat, you can go there 1,200 days plus and counting of What This Vegan Eats with my partner, Gary DiMattei. And that blog resides at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Okay, I'm going to move on to another subject. This really isn't related to food, but maybe I'll find a way to tie it in. I want to say that words matter. Words matter in so many ways. I happen to be the owner, a shareholder, I should say, of my apartment in a building in New York City, in a co-op building. Co-ops are very popular in New York. And we have a co-op board. There's been a lot of humor about co-op boards, how difficult they are to deal with, and they make a lot of decisions for the building. It's actually a difficult job, and they're all volunteer, so I'm grateful for that. Every year we have a meeting where we go over the health of the building, the financials, the projects coming up, and people get to air their problems. And we vote in new board members. Usually it's the same slate as the year before. Occasionally there are changes. And we get a proxy form that we use to vote with. And people who can't make the meeting use the form to give it to someone else so that their vote can be heard. I moved here in 1999, and I went to the first annual board meeting in 1999, shortly after I moved in, and I was horrified by the language used in the proxy. It opened up with, "No all men. No all men, blah, 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 blah." Who are they talking to? No all men. I would say about half the shareholders, maybe even more, are women. I was horrified by this language, and I said so back in 1999. That was 19 years ago, and they remedied it. They changed it, and everything was fine until this year. It came back 19 years later. We have a proxy that has this archaic sexist language, no all men, and I got a smirk from the new lawyer when I brought up my issues with the language, and I'm assuming that they will change it at least for maybe another couple of decades until it comes back again. And maybe there were some people there that rolled their eyes and thought, oh, we have much more important things to talk about, and there she goes again complaining about, oh, some silly words. They're not silly words, they're important. And every opportunity that we have to speak out and make things better, we should. We need to be involved and not sitting back. If you're sitting back, if you're not speaking out about anything that's wrong, then you're supporting what's wrong. And if it's something really subtle, I think it's even more important because those kind of things work at us subliminally. No, all men, because the women don't matter. Well, I think we matter, everybody. So I got loud. and hopefully it'll be changed. But it makes me think, and I'm going to connect this to food. Yes, I am. We like to copy and paste. So I'm assuming that's what happened. There was some other proxy that they had on file. They grabbed the language and just pasted it and continued on. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But We need to proofread. We need to read what we're saying. We need to be involved, not just cut and paste. It matters. Everything matters. Either everything matters or nothing matters. So how does this connect with food? Well, there are lots of myths that continue to be shared because people aren't taking the time to see if these things are true, or they're copying and pasting, or they look and they see some article written somewhere and just repeat the information without verifying that it's true and not taking the time to get involved. Get involved with what you're sharing, get involved with what you're saying, and making sure that it's something worthwhile and something true. So a couple of things that really irk me, you've heard me talk about this before in this line of thought, is something called food combining. And there are two kinds of issues or two kinds of myths related to food combining. The first is that our digestion needs help from us in some ways, that it doesn't know how to digest the food. There are hundreds of thousands of things that go on in our bodies every second that we don't have a clue about. It's beautiful. We don't really need to get involved. And our body, it's like a chem lab inside. It's amazing what it can do without instruction from us. The idea is that we shouldn't combine proteins with starches. We should eat fruits separately. We shouldn't eat one thing with another. There's no science behind it. It doesn't hold up. And I'm not saying that people don't have digestion issues. Many people today have digestion issues. And this is a serious and complicated problem. And some people may have found relief by doing this food combining thing, but it's not because there's any truth in the food combining. It's that maybe they found that there's a food or several foods that they have issues with, and by not eating them or by not eating them with other foods, they were able to digest them better. It's an individual thing. It's not something that you can say to everyone, eat this and don't eat this or don't mix this with that. Personally, I know I don't do well drinking orange juice. Now, orange juice, I don't recommend drinking because we should eat the whole food, the orange. But I find when I drink orange juice, it upsets my stomach. So I don't drink orange juice. It's a simple thing. You find out what doesn't work for you and you avoid it. Or maybe you can find a way if it's something really nutritious and you want to learn how to enjoy it. There are ways to develop the microflora in your digestive system to be able to eat the food comfortably by eating a little teeny bit every day and then adding a little bit more until you finally up to a serving of the food without any discomfort. The point is, this food combining theory is a myth. It's not supported by any science. It doesn't hold up. The other food combining myth is the one about protein, where we need to combine different foods in order to make what's called a complete protein. A complete protein has the 8 or 9 essential amino acids that our bodies cannot make ourselves. This is another myth, and it keeps getting regurgitated. People copy and paste it either from a website or somewhere that they've read it, and they keep recycling these falsehoods. They're false. And that's good news, because it's easy to eat healthfully. You shouldn't have to count calories. You shouldn't have to think to yourself, am I getting enough antioxidants, flavonoids, protein, fat, whatever, if you're eating a wide variety of colorful, whole, minimally processed plant foods, you are getting what you need. Okay, there are always exceptions to the rule, but for the most part, for most people, it's not complicated. You don't need to think about every meal and think, oh, am I getting the right amino acids in this meal? Your body is smart. And when I say to get involved with your life, this is one place where you don't really have to be involved. The bodily functions that our body does naturally without help from our conscious mind. And that makes me think of something. There's also our unconscious mind, our subconscious, or those voices in our head that are always saying things to us and probably saying things that aren't very nice. And that's why I always encourage people to script their own affirmations, script the voices in their heads so that the voices are saying nice things, lovely things, supportive things, rather than all those judgmental things, because that will affect your digestion. When you're getting all these negative voices, you get all those juices churning up inside. And you can get irritated that way and cause problems. And when you're thinking lovely thoughts, think lovely thoughts. Who knows what that's from? Peter Pan. Don't get me sidetracked talking about Peter Pan. Maybe I'll get back to that later. But the idea is when we think lovely thoughts, we help our body function in balance the way it's supposed to. It's healthy to experience joy. It's healthy to feel good. So here we are. Let's take a good breathing moment and find a place where the light is shining within you and you can kind of wrap your arms around it and give it a big hug. We need to do that to ourselves all the time, especially when we're not getting it from anywhere else. Some of us are fortunate to have a lot of wonderful people around us. Others are not. Whatever the case, we need to be involved in our own lives and love ourselves. Hey, that's what I think. Next subject. You know I'm a tea lover, right? Well, these last 3 weeks, if you've been reading my blog, you'll know that my partner Gary DiMattei is in California, and I am joining him actually later today. I'll be flying out to California. And we are directing into the woods this summer for a company in San Jose, California. If you're anywhere near there, you might find your way to San Jose the first week of August for Playful People Productions performances of Into the Woods. We have an age-appropriate adult cast, and we have a teen cast, too. It's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of hard work. What I've been doing here at home is clearing out all the fresh food in the refrigerator and working out the stuff that's in the pantry so that there's really nothing. And I've succeeded. I'm leaving in a few hours, and there is nothing left. There's a few things in the freezer, but I really got rid of most things, and there are a few things in the refrigerator. I like to keep grains and flours in the refrigerator, so they'll stay fresh in there longer until we come home. But the pantry's pretty much cleared out, and I like doing that because I think it's important, not just with fresh food, but any kind of food, that we keep moving it. You don't want something sitting in your refrigerator, your freezer, or your pantry for years. It's really not good. I've had a number of grain products, especially rice, that people may have had on their shelves for a long time. And frankly, I can taste it. It's a little rancid. It's a little stale. It's not a good flavor. And it may not be good for you either. So move. Keep moving the food. Keep moving the food. That's my recommendation. So this is what I've been doing. Moving the food. And it's resulted in some interesting meals. So the last few days, as I've been out of my mirepoix, my foods that give my soups and sauces flavors, like onions, celery, and carrots, I've been going to my spice and herb collection. I have a lot of them, and it really makes a difference, adding flavor to foods. I also have this thing where I want to use up all the onion powder that we have, because I buy herbs and spices in bulk, and I found that the onion powder that we get, I guess there's moisture in it because over time it becomes a solid block and you can't scoop it out. I haven't quite figured out the solution to this, and if you have some ideas, please help me at info@realmeals.org. But sometimes I break it all up and I put it in a spice grinder and I make it a powder again, and it's fine. I use it. So there's just a little left, and I was determined to use it all up. I'm not quite there yet. But I find that when I add a lot of onion powder to things, like instead of a teaspoon, I might add 2 tablespoons. The flavor is amazing for soups and sauces. So don't hold back. There are some spices you don't want to add too much of because they're very strong and they're very overpowering. Peppers, chipotle, and what else? Ginger. Those are really strong. Turmeric. I've been putting turmeric in everything. Now, some people say turmeric and some people say turmeric. You know what I'm talking about. That orange spice that I spent an hour talking about last week. Too much of that can be very strange. So you have to be careful. But onion powder? I think onion powder is pretty safe. And if you add more of it, you'll have more flavor. So I've been doing that. And when I was out of greens a couple of days ago, I started adding more dried herbs like parsley and basil just to green up my dishes a little bit. This may be silly, but I find that when I restrict my food intake, and this happened when I was young and I became a vegetarian. Well, first I eliminated meat and chicken, and then I eliminated fish, and then I eliminated dairy and eggs. And then for a time, I was only eating raw. And now I'm eating more of a whole food, plant-based, vegan diet of cooked and raw. And I'm working towards staying away from really refined foods, sugars and flours, those sorts of things. I find that when I restrict, I learn a lot and I get more creative. So even though it's kind of a crazy thing what I'm doing here, I've had fun with it. And I've come up with some fun recipes as a result. And you can benefit because I posted some of them at Responsible Eating and Living. I hope you check them out. One of them was a spin-off of a dish called Two Kinds Mushroom Congee. Two Kinds Mushroom Congee. I used to go to a restaurant here in Queens, New York called Buddha Bodai. And there's also there's two of them now in Manhattan. And they've changed owners and hands and locations, whatever. They used to have this dish, and I'm sure that some of them still do, Two Kinds Mushroom Congee. Congee is a soup made with rice cooked with lots and lots of water. Normally when we cook a whole grain or a polished grain like white rice, we'll use 1 cup of rice to 2 cups of water, a 2-to-1 ratio water to grain, sometimes a little more water. But when you make congee, you use a lot more water, and you cook it and cook it and cook it until the rice ultimately just like dissolves and you have this creamy porridge or soup. And I used to get this congee that was made with mushrooms and ginger, and oh, so fantastic. Fantastic. And I had a bunch of fresh ginger in the refrigerator, so that needed to go. I had a package of tempeh. That needed to go. I always have tons of rice and stuff, but I didn't want to eat rice. I had a bunch of rice already. I don't want to eat rice all the time. We're concerned about the arsenic in rice. And if you haven't heard about arsenic in rice, you can Google it. Or you can send me an email at info@realmeals.org and I'll share some links with you. But there is arsenic in the soil primarily, now get this, primarily because arsenic is used in chicken farms to prevent illness in the chickens because they're so close together and confined, and then they poop and there's arsenic in their excrement, and then that goes into fertilizer. And we put that on our farms, and then the rice seem to like to take it up. So it's been discovered that many rice varieties have very high levels of arsenic, and they should be avoided. And there are some that have less amounts, and I've been going with the varieties that have less and aren't too troublesome if I'm not eating them every day. Because I love rice. And rice does have a lot of nutrition. So I've been eating California brown basmati rice. That scored reasonably low. But I still didn't want to have rice. I think I had hit my rice quota. And I made a congee of sorts by grating the tempeh so that it looked like rice. I riced the tempeh. And I added a lot of fresh ginger. I have dried mushrooms. I get them from Fungus Amungus. I buy them in bulk. I'm so in love with my dried mushrooms because they're always there and they add a lot of flavor and nutrition. I love them all, but I used the shiitake mushrooms this time. Cook them up with the tempeh, the ginger, water. I added a lot of onion powder. And I made this dish, and it was so satisfying, and it reminded me of the two kinds mushroom congee. I could have used two kinds of mushrooms, but I just wanted to use shiitake. So we'll call it one kind mushroom congee. I just call it mushroom ginger congee. And it was really good. So that was something that came out of lack, or the appearance of lack, that I didn't have anything to eat. But I did. And I made this wonderful dish with it. I think I started this conversation talking about tea. Did I talk about tea yet? I know I didn't finish. So part of this exercise of clearing the house, we drink a lot of tea. We buy our tea in bulk. I get a lot of tea from Arbor Tea. It's a company that sells mostly organic fair trade teas, and I like their products. And I like drinking both tea, and I'm going to tell you why in a minute. But I also have a lovely little red cherry tea box that I can put different tea bags in. And a few decades ago, I used to treasure these boxes with the little tea bags. I thought it was such a lovely thing, and I just enjoyed my collection of different tea bags. But I've woken up, and I've gotten a little more involved with my life. And when I think about a tea bag, think about it. Not only do you have to grow the leaves for the tea, and that takes a lot, and then harvest them and dry them and process them, ship them and have them purchased so that you can have tea. Not only is there that, but now for tea bags, we have to have the tea bag itself, the little staple that closes it, the string that goes inside it, with the little square piece of paper with the printing on it, sometimes with a nice little positive saying. And then all of that is wrapped in either plastic or some more printed paper, and all of that goes into a box. And sometimes that box will have paper inside of it or wax paper, and then there's the cardboard box itself with the printing on it. All of that for a cup of tea. It boggles my mind. And now that I am awake, I think I can't stand drinking tea with a tea bag for so many reasons. One is I'm a snob, and bulk tea tastes so much better. Bulk tea tastes better, especially with clean, pure water. And as you know, I love my distilled water that I distill all the time with my Aqua Nui distiller, because I want to be involved with my life, and I want to, as much as possible, enjoy every moment. Why? Because I'm worth it. And you know what? I think you're worth it. When you put energy into something, you get more out of it. When you're not involved with your life, you're not going to get much out of it. It's that simple. How uninvolved do you want to be with your life, says artist Tom Lieber. And I say, how involved do you want to be in your life? Get involved. And if you're drinking tea, try bulk tea. And it's easy. There are so many different kinds of pots and cups with these convenient little baskets. You can put the bulk tea in, and then when you're done, you rinse it. If you compost, you can take those leaves and put them right there in the compost. It's a beautiful thing, no waste. And the tea is fantastic. So what I'm doing is I have a lot of tea bags, and I don't know where they came from because I haven't bought them. Somehow they just appear. For those who have given me tea bags as gifts, thank you very much for your thoughtfulness. And I'm moving some of those out. And what I've done, okay, this is where Karen really gets crazy. I take the tea bags, I kind of group them in terms of similar teas, greens and herbal teas, whatever, and I'll take a pot of water and I snip open the tea bags and I pour the leaves, or if it's herbal, whatever the flavorings are, into my basket. So it's like bulk tea, because frankly, I find that bulk tea brews better than tea in a paper bag or a nylon stocking. Yeah, those silk tea bags, they're like pantyhose. Just think about that for a minute. Dipping your tea in pantyhose. It's nylon. It's some kind of polymer that they make those silky, quote, silky baskets. And they charge more for those because it looks finer. They come in these lovely shapes, these beautiful little pouches. But just think about how they were made, the energy that went into making them, and the fact that you're dipping them in hot water and probably getting some of the things in them that you really don't want to be drinking. Okay, so maybe some light bulbs have gone on for some of you, and I hope if you're tea drinkers, you'll think about looking into bulk tea. And you know, coffee drinkers, this applies to you too. Now, I know a lot of people go to Starbucks and Pete's and coffee shops and get coffee every day in a cardboard cup, which is not particularly environmentally friendly. It's an expensive venture. If you're making coffee at home, for those of you who don't want to be involved in your lives, you've probably gone to a Keurig or some other easy coffee machine. And it's the same thing as making tea. The quality isn't as good. There's all this plastic and waste involved, all these extra steps, all of this, quote, added value that allows companies to charge you more money. And you're not getting a better product. You are not getting a product that is better for you. You are not getting a product that is better for the planet. And while I'm asking you how involved you want to be with your life, I also want to ask, what is the cost of convenience? What is the cost of convenience in your life? Is it costing you a degradation in your health? Is it costing a degradation in the health of the environment, which affects you and your family? What is the cost of convenience? Convenience, efficiency. These are words that I have to wrap my head around a lot because there's so much involved with convenience and efficiency that we don't think about. And I'm inviting you to think about it. And do something about it to make this world a better place. Now, you may know this. I love talking about food. I really try to hold back in public situations because I could just talk all day about food. But I wait until I'm welcomed to do so. I know that the response is not going to be very good when I'm shoving ideas into people's heads when they're not welcomed. I took a ride yesterday with a Lyft driver. I have to tell you, I'm not a big user of Lyft or Uber or taxis. They have their purpose. I'm not saying yay or nay. It's just something I don't do very often. I walk. I take the subway, the train, and planes, and rent cars. That's pretty much how I get around. But I did take a Lyft ride yesterday with a very nice driver named Sebastian. And as we were riding to my destination, the train station, we had a great conversation about many, many things. And one of them was food. How did I manage to sneak that in? Well, I don't know, but I did, and it was easy and friendly. And I was telling Sebastian that maybe this was a ride or a journey to better health. This little ride that we were sharing together. because he definitely needed some help, and I gave him my card and my website name for more information. I gave him a few little tips, and I hope maybe he's listening. Hi, Sebastian. Hi, thanks for that great ride, and I hope you are continuing on your journey to better health. You're a nice guy, and you deserve it. And he was just one classic example of the people in America who have been manipulated by corporations to put things in our bodies that do not nurture us. And it's not just America, of course. We've sold this concept to the rest of the world. And it doesn't feel good. And you know what? I don't want you to feel good. That's all it is. Tuning in love here with me on It's All About Food. My goal is for everybody to feel good and experience joy because it's possible. But we have to do it ourselves. It doesn't just happen. And we can kind of help other people as well, which is what I'm trying to do. So I gave him a few tips and we talked a little bit about dairy. And he was saying, yeah, the milk was giving me some problems, so now I have the lactaid product. And then I had to calmly, maybe not that calmly, explain to him what happens in the dairy industry and how milk is made. And it's not a very pleasant thing. I've talked about it many times on this show. Making a cow pregnant, because it's the only way she's going to have milk, is to have a baby calf, and to inseminate her is a pornographic and cruel process. To get the bull to give semen is also a pornographic and cruel process. You can Google it and look online and see how it's done. It's all up there. Universities have guidelines on how to do this. It blows my mind. And then, of course, the baby is born and taken away from the mom, and a few weeks later is served up as veal. And then the milk has the antibiotics and hormones in it. Even without those things, milk is a hormone soup made for a cow to grow to like a 600-pound animal in a very short amount of time. It's not for human consumption. And all mammals, except humans, wean themselves at an early age. I explained a lot of this to Sebastian. I hope he got it. And then he asked me, is almond milk okay? And I'm like, yeah, there are lots of wonderful plant milks out there. Just make sure it's unsweetened because you don't want to add extra sugar when you're having some of these plant milks. So maybe the last thing I want to talk about on this program where we're talking about being involved in our lives is reading labels. Because if you're buying plant milks, if you're trying plant milks, I recommend you read the label. Plant milks are becoming very popular today, and that's great. But as more companies jump in and offer you plant milk because they want a piece of the profit, they're going to put different ingredients that you may or may not want in your milk. For example, I drink soy milk. My soy milk is made with soybeans and water. I only know two companies who sell this, and that's West Soy, the original, and Trader Joe's. All other soy milk seems to come with vitamins and gums and all kinds of things that I don't want in my soy milk. Now, some people choose to have enriched plant milks that come with different vitamins, and that's a choice. I like to know if I'm supplementing vitamins, how much I'm getting, and so I will take them in a pill where I can be aware of the dose. When I'm drinking different foods that are enriched, I'm not sure how much I'm getting, enough or maybe too much. And then there are the gums and the sugars and the salts and the oils. So please try plant milks. Wean yourself off the dairy if you haven't already. It's important for yourself, your family, and the planet. And please, for the cows and the calves and the bulls. But read the ingredients, because you want the best. All right, everybody. We've come to the end of another program. I hope you have enjoyed our discussion today. We've covered a lot of ground on this program about being involved with your life. If you get a chance to see Eating Animals, tell me what you think. You can find me at info@realmeals.org. I'm off to California, and I'll talk to you from over there. In the meantime, have a delicious week. Thank you.